than we're meant to be. So welcome everybody. This talk was originally called The Buddhist Approach to Lack, but we didn't think that was attractive enough, so we changed it to dealing with not having a Buddhist approach to dealing with not having what you want. And I realised as I was starting to make some notes about this that I was sliding into giving the same talk that I gave 2 years ago on a different subject. So I've avoided that temptation. And we're trying to give some... what I'd like to do is give a couple of short-term answers, or answers that work in the short term to that question, and then maybe look at why we experience not having what we want more generally, and a sort of long-term approach to managing it. And the first thing to say is that in the first sermon that the Buddha gave on the Four Noble Truths, when he talked about the first truth of dukkha, or it's usually translated as suffering, but something like discomfort or bad space, he makes a list of examples of the kind of thing that he's talking about. It's a mixture of physical things and psychological things. And one of the things in that list is not getting what you want. Another one is being associated with things or with people that you don't like. Being separated from people that you do like. And the reason he included those in that list, or the whole point of giving that list and making it the beginning of his talk, was to say these are unavoidable facts of life. If you're in this world, sometimes you'll be separated from people that you love. Sometimes there'll be things that you want that you can't have. So it's unavoidable. And yet we still insist on reacting to it as if it is avoidable, or as if it's the worst thing in the world. And as that talk is part of the Four Noble Truths, that hints at one approach to dealing with not having what you want, which is to go through the Four Noble Truths and to work with the Four Noble Truths. And I've certainly talked about that before. And if you want to look at that in much more detail, you should get hold of The Feeling Buddha, in which David Bracer goes through the Four Noble Truths and really talks about how they can work in your own life to live a life, a good life, in the face of not having what you want. Because essentially, the reason they're called Noble Truths is because what he's saying is, it's possible to live a noble life, even though all these things are features of the life that we have. We don't have to be affected by encountering loss in a way that leads us to behave harmfully towards ourselves and others. Actually, we can encounter loss. We can encounter not having what we want. And we can use that as motivation to behave compassionately in the world. Now, I may say some more about that later, but that's the area that my other talk was in. And as much as for my own sake as for yours, really, I wanted to try and think of some different things to say this morning. If you're a Buddhist teacher, if you say the same thing over and over again, you can actually become very successful because people like to hear the same thing over and over and over again. But the downside is it actually gets quite boring if you're that teacher. So I wanted to say some different things this morning. Caroline Screen asked us, we always record the talk, but she especially wanted to listen to this. So she said, can you make sure you record it today? Because I'm going to be away. She's gone away to see a partner in Wales for the weekend. Well, that's one example of not having what you want. She wanted to be here and listen to the talk, and she isn't. So how is she managing that? Well, in two ways, and perhaps those two ways give us some clues as to how we can manage it in our own life. The first is actually that we are recording the talk, so she'll get something a bit like it. I'm not sure that's a successful strategy all the time. You can't, you know, a recording of all of life's events doesn't quite work, you know. I was thinking of examples and my mind went blank, but you can all think, you know, if you've got a photograph of something, it's not the same. If you've got a photograph of a music concert, it's not the same as being at the music concert, but maybe maybe it gives you a little bit of relief to have the poster or the photograph on your wall. But the other way is, what's the problem of not having what you want? It's usually not the fact of not having what you want. It's usually the emotional reaction that comes afterwards, which can be a grasping for it when it's out of reach. It can be a kind of grief reaction. It can be anger, sorrow, and all those things are unpleasant to live with. And that's what causes the discomfort, really, as much as not having the thing itself. If Satya hadn't bought me this cup of tea, I could have spent all through the talk thinking about not having a cup of tea, or I could have thought, well, okay, I haven't got a cup of tea, but I really need to focus on giving the talk now, so I've got people here. And actually, when I'm talking to you, when my attention's on the people in this room and on the subject that I'm talking about, that's taking up most of my attention. So I forget about not having a cup of tea. That's the same with Caroline. I hope that she is completely absorbed by a weekend away with her partner and not sitting there thinking, I really wish I was in Melbourne listening to Casper. Okay, part of me does think wish that she was thinking, I really wish I was in Melbourne listening to Casper. But that shows quite a good way of dealing with not having what you want is to put your attention into something else worthwhile, because there's only so much space in your mind. And for many of the things that we don't get, or the things that we do get and we don't like, simply giving our attention to something else is enough to take the energy out of that that thought cycle, that emotional cycle that's causing us the problems. And absorption or concentration is one of the skills that's really admired and taught in traditions of Buddhism where they teach meditation. So there's an example in one of the sutras where the Buddha is meditating and he's very deep in concentration on the object of his meditation. So much so that when he finishes meditation, he comes out and looks around him. There's pools of water all around, and it was dry before. He says to one of his disciples, oh, have I missed something? And he said, oh, there's a massive thunderstorm. When you're meditating, did you not notice? And he'd been so deeply involved in the meditation practice he was doing, he didn't notice the huge thunderstorm, the lightning, the thunder, the rain coming down, leaving all this water on the road. It was only as he emerged from the meditation that he realized this was happening. We could take two things from this. One is that his concentration was so fixed on the object of attention, on the object of meditation, there wasn't room for anything else. But if you're able to give your attention to that same degree to what is important, to the job that is in front of you, to whatever the realities of the situation, then you're not going to be worried about X, Y, and Z, because actually, well, you don't need to pay attention to those. So when I'm talking to you here, if I give all of my attention to giving this talk and to you, then I'm not worried about whether I've got a cup of tea or not, because all of my energy actually is going into something else. The other thing we can take from it is that not all meditations are about being in the present moment, which is another talk really, but it does illustrate that fact that there are meditative practices that are about becoming involved in a particular object of attention, either in your mind or in the world, in a really focused way and not necessarily about being aware of everything that's happening to you. Although that is another useful thing to do. So that's one strategy for dealing with not having what you want, is to give your energy to something else. And if you've ever, if you've had a relationship that's ended, one of the best things that you can do to help yourself move on is to find a project to be involved with, to find something else to pull you forwards. And the reason for this is it takes us into a little bit of Buddhist psychology. our state of mind is conditioned by many different things. It's conditioned by what we were thinking a few minutes ago. It's conditioned by the experiences of all our lives leading up to this moment. It's also really heavily conditioned by what we give our attention to. So, if I haven't got a cup of tea, but I keep looking and seeing Wendy's cup of tea, Benny's cup of tea, Brian's cup of tea, then actually every time I give my attention to those things, that's going to send me into that cycle of resenting the fact that I haven't got a cup of tea. I have got a cup of tea, so it's no problem for me to notice that. In the same way, if you've got objects around that remind you of what you're missing, it's going to trigger that cycle, that emotional cycle. Now, in some cases, it's very appropriate to remember things and actually to feel a sense of lack and of sadness. So I guess this strategy that I'm talking about now is for times when it's less appropriate. You know, if you've lost somebody, then it's probably okay to have a photo of them that reminds you of them and to feel and to go through the stages of grief. Actually, although those emotions are unpleasant, there's nothing wrong with being in that relationship to something that's missing. Unless it starts to continually affect the rest of your life. In which case, you might want to think about putting some of these strategies in place. But if it's something, you know, if it's gone beyond the point where you think, actually, it's okay for me to be worrying about this thing that I've lost. Or you think, actually, it's not helpful for me to think about this thing that I've lost because I'm not going to get it. And, it, you know, when I think about it, it's not hugely significant whether I've got a cup of tea or not. In those cases, it makes a lot of sense to give your attention to something else. It's when you give your attention to something else that affects how your mind is. If you're sitting at your desk typing, dealing with lots of emails, lots of stressful things that are kind of happening at work that you need to deal with, every time you go to where your desk is, all of those associations come up. And, you know, I notice this when I've got that kind of work going on. If I go into my office, I become a little bit more tense. Part of me wants to immediately reach the computer to see if I can fix whatever the situation is, even though it's unfixable sometimes by me. And if I keep going into my office, it keeps triggering that cycle of worry, of me wanting to be in control of things that I can't be in control of. And it keeps me in a state that leads to me not being skillful when I send the emails because I'm too worried about them, or not being able to give my attention to things that are important in the rest of the house because I keep being drawn back in to the office. One really good antidote to that kind of behaviour is not to go into the office, but to go into the garden instead. So yesterday, I did an hour of weeding in the afternoon, and it completely cleared those feelings that I had about being around my computer desk and doing that kind of work. I had to concentrate to decide to see, is that a weed or is it something that should be there? Is that earth, or is it where the cats use the vegetable bed to go to the toilet, in which case I need to be a bit more careful about that area? And when I'm in that process and completely giving my attention to the gardening, I'm not giving my attention to the work in my office. Every time I give my attention to something that's unhelpful like that, whether it's something that's missing or something that's present that I don't want to be there, it's like injecting more energy into the cycle of worry and flurry. Some things, when you simply stop pushing more energy into them, they die down of their own accord. So the kind of thing that I'm talking about at the moment, going and doing something else, works for some things. It works for some kind of mental patterns. Because many of the mental patterns that we have, when we stop feeding them, they disappear on their own and we don't need to do anything else. Some of the mental patterns that we have, even when we stop feeding them, there's enough fuel in us already that they keep going, and then maybe we need to do something different. What is at the root of those thoughts that drive us to worry, that keep our minds being frenetic, that keep us stressed out? We started by talking about things that were missing or things that were present that we didn't enjoy. Like, you know, I'm using this as a mundane example, but, you know, if Satya had made me a coffee and I'd asked for tea, that would be something else for my mind to turn over. But it's not the actual contents of this cup that makes the difference as to whether I go into a cycle of worry and stress or not. It's whether there's any conceit in me, whether there's any selfishness in me. We have particular ideas of who we are, almost like a painting that we have of ourselves, and we think, oh well, that's who I am, but there's, in reality, there's differences between that painting of ourselves and actually who we really are in the world. There's parts of ourselves that we don't like to see. There's parts of ourselves that we like to see differently. And this is true physically, but it's also true with our minds as well, and thought patterns. There's particular responses that we have to people in the world, maybe, that we don't want to acknowledge, because that would challenge this painting that we have of ourselves, which maybe is much nicer than how we really are. Or for some people, might even be much worse than who they really are. You know, some people have those sorts of paintings and so on. When I say selfishness or conceit, what I really mean is a bit of us that we're invested in not seeing as it really is. That's usually what's underneath selfishness. So let me think of an example I've been speaking in abstract terms. For a very long time, and still even now a little bit, I wasn't very good at being criticized. When somebody would tell me that I'd done something wrong or wasn't quite right, even if there was no malice intended in their comment, I would take it really badly. But I didn't like to think that I was the sort of person who took criticism badly, because that didn't fit with the image that I'd got of myself. So instead, I would just say that it was the other person's fault. They were mean, they didn't know what they were talking about. And that protected me in a particular way. It protected the image that I'd got of myself, of being somebody who was better than I was. And also protected, so there were two things it was protecting. That part of me that liked to think that I could take criticism, but also the part of me that liked to get everything right. And if I'm being criticized, then I haven't got something right somewhere. Well, I can't bear to admit that I haven't got something right. So it must be the other person that's wrong. When I go into that habit pattern, that cycle, what happens is actually I get more and more wound up, takes a huge amount of energy because I'm hiding from the truth. And actually, to not see something takes quite a lot of energy. And I end up carrying my anger for the other person with me, often for days and days it would be. Now, I've been through a process of recognising that actually, not only do I not deal with criticism very well, I can also, very, very rarely, I can also be wrong. Although it does pain me to admit that. Maybe we'll delete that bit from the tape. In seeing that and admitting it, two things happen. One is that all the energy that I was putting into to maintaining that of my image of myself is released. So suddenly I probably feel less tired and more awake. The other thing that happens is I'm able to start accepting those parts of myself, which means I've got no need to keep blaming the other person. What happens in that? You know, what was happening before is that in order to keep me from seeing what was true, which was that I'd made a mistake and then I didn't want to hear about it, I would keep having to push the truth away and keep having to being angry with other people. Well, that process is what kept me in a state of being worried or depressed or passive aggressive, all those things that actually I was trying to avoid feeling. Ironically, I was making myself feeling them more and more and more. When I was able to recognise that that was happening and start to accept those parts of myself, there's no longer any need for me to be angry with those people, because I don't need to protect that self-image that I've got anymore, because it becomes closer to the real me. So I don't need to keep putting that energy into protecting myself, into not seeing that I make mistakes, into being angry with those people. Well, the result of that is actually, if I'm not doing that, if I'm not putting energy into that cycle, then I'm not feeling passive aggressive, I'm not feeling depressed, I'm not feeling stressed out. And suddenly, all those things that I was feeling, that I didn't want to be feeling, disappear. So that's another strategy for dealing with things, not only for dealing with things that you don't have, but really, I guess there's many different triggers for that kind of pattern being set up, that kind of emotional storm that we create around things. If we can identify the bit of truth that we're avoiding in that storm, and I call it conceit or selfishness because it's usually to do with us rather than anything in the world. It's usually to do with protecting us from seeing ourselves in a particular way. We can identify that and start to accept it, then it takes the wind out of the sails of that emotional storm. So that's another really good strategy for, or maybe not for dealing with not having what you want, but for dealing with the emotional reaction that comes from not having what you want. We've talked about two things so far. One is giving your attention to something else, because for many of the reactions that we have, when we simply stop feeding the reactions, they disappear. And the other is, the second one I've just talked about, is identifying the part of us that's fueling those reactions, even when we're unaware of it. You know, that unconscious protecting of yourself or of myself in that situation. Those are both really good things to do if you notice yourself getting worked up because you haven't got something that you want. Something else that I wanted to mention is the story of Kisagatami, who became one of the Buddha's disciples in India 2,500 years ago. She arrived full of grief in front of the Buddha. And he said, you know, what's the problem? And she was going mad with grief. She said, my son's died, my baby's died. And I can't get over it. And I've heard that you can help. You've got some special magical powers that can take away the suffering that I'm feeling. And he thought, well, if she thinks that, then maybe I can use that to help her, actually. He said, okay, so I can make you something. I can use my magical powers to help you take away this suffering. But in order to do that, I need you to bring me something. And she said, okay, what, you know, whatever it is, I'll go find it and bring it back to you, because I really want to get rid of this grief, this suffering. I've been holding on to it for too long. He said, I need you to bring me a mustard seed from a house in the village, but it has to be from the house where nobody has suffered a loss, where nobody has suffered a grief. No. At that time in India, families lived together in houses. Also, they weren't the same kind of public health care and medical systems that we have today. So he knew when he asked her to do that, that that house didn't exist in the village. But she went door to door anyway. Oh, I need to get a mustard seed from the house of somebody who hasn't experienced loss. I'm sorry, we lost an uncle, we lost a son, we lost a daughter, we lost a wife, we lost a mother. Every house that she went to, somebody in that family had died. And as she went through this process, her grief changed from being deeply personal to being universal. The personal sense of grief is like feeling wronged, is wanting the person to be brought back to you specifically. It's almost feeling like the universe has got a vendetta against you. It's getting really upset that somebody didn't. I don't know why I'm banging on about a cup of tea, because I have got one. There must be something in it. Whereas when you experience, when you encounter other people's loss of the same degree, your grief changes and transforms from feeling like you've been hard done by to actually feeling fellow feeling and compassion for other people. Because what you're going through, they've been through. And not only that, what they've been through, you're going through. So as well as making you more able to empathize with other people, also gives you a sense of not being alone, of being in a community of people who have all experienced grief and loss. In this society, we're not very good at talking about that kind of loss, about people dying. I bet if you went around this street and asked for a mustard seed, the problem you would encounter is not that people would all tell you about their griefs, but that they'd be less likely to have mustard seeds in their houses. But I think they would be less likely to tell you or to remember that somebody had died, because we like to cover that up in the kind of Western society that we have. But the experience of Kisagatami is really important for us to remember, because when we are suffering, if we can remember it, if we can use that suffering as a way to empathize with other people, we can transform our experience from a deeply personal suffering, which can actually feel very painful, to what Suzuki Roshi called the great grief, which is the experience of being with the suffering of the whole world, which can feel deeply sad, but it doesn't feel so tight, it doesn't feel so anguished. It's a real deep acceptance of the reality of things that leads you to more loving actions in the world. Kisagatami came back to the Buddha. She didn't need him to make her a magic potion using the mustard seed, because she'd already had her grief transformed. And there's a story that goes alongside that, which is when she was at the well a little while later, she tipped over a bucket of water, and she noticed the earth was very dry. She noticed that each little stream of water was a different length before it dropped down a crack into the earth. And that image spoke to her about how each thing that comes into the world stays for a different amount of time. There's no, we don't get to choose how long things remain for. From things that inspire powerful grief, like people, to, you know, on a more mundane level, sometimes we break plates in the kitchen, or somebody else does. To imagine that we can be in control of how long anything stays for is a mistake. To experience, as she did, a real deep bodily sense of some things last for longer than others, some things last for shorter than others. That's a really profound awakening. And actually that moment of her spilling the water and seeing the different lengths of the little rivulets of water before they drained away, that's described in the sutras as her enlightenment experience. For her, the most powerful awakening that she could have was to the impermanence of things and how things, some things last for a long time, some things last for a short time. And if you can practice being with that in a way that isn't deeply personal but is more universal, then actually you're well on the way to dealing with things that you don't have. So there's no easy answer, you know. There isn't a magic formula that I can give you. You know, you're not going to be able to get, even if you could go and get a mustard seed from the house that hasn't experienced grief in Malvern, that's not going to work. It's not going to bring back the plate that you dropped or the person that you left. What's going to transform your experience of that is a deep acceptance of the fact that everything that comes into the world goes from the world. So that's the third thing I wanted to talk about. Kesagatami's experience of grief. The fourth thing that I wanted to talk about is the kind of more Pure Land approach. And it starts from an awareness of how we put our trust in. Maybe that's not the right way of saying it. The reason that we experience all those feelings in relation to things that we lose or that we don't have when we want them is because we've staked part of our sense of well-being on those things being around. If I'm not invested in having a nicest car as my neighbour, it doesn't bother me when my neighbour gets a really nice car. If it's really important to me to have a better car than my neighbour, when they go out and buy a Corvette, I'm going to get really upset about it because we've just got a Fiat 500. So it's about a misplaced, it's about relying on something that isn't guaranteed. If I'm relying on something like that for my sense of well-being, then inevitably at some point I'm going to get disappointed by it. If I'm relying on always having all the cups of tea that I want, then at some point I'm going to get disappointed because I'm not surrounded by beings who attend to my every need, much as I would like that to be the case. We do this all the time. We rely on work to give us status, or income to give us status, or having more hair than our younger brother to give us a sense of well-being. Sorry, Adrian, if you're listening to the recording. But those things will change, you know. Eventually I lose my hair, we lose our jobs, our income changes. You know, you might get lucky and the thing that you're relying on might be there for as long as you need it to be there. But it's very, very unlikely. And actually, we don't tend to rely on just one thing. We tend to rely on a few different things. For all of the things that you rely on to feel good about yourself, to keep being there, it's not going to happen. Because we put our trust in the wrong thing. We do this because, and this is why I originally called the talk Dealing with Lack, because I believe there is a sense of lack that most people experience. A hole of sort of unfulfilled meaning or something anyway that's in us. And that's the hole that we try to plug with all of these different things. With making sure that our car is nicer than our neighbours, with making sure that we've got nicer clothes than everybody else in the street, or that we get the promotion, or that we've got more money than our friend, you know, whatever it is. Or that we try to plug with chocolate or alcohol or new shoes. And we keep doing that and it keeps doesn't working. And we might then change the object and try and plug it with other things. Oh, well, that didn't work, so I'll try a relationship. Well, that's pretty good, but it's not completely satisfying. Or the person goes away, you know, there's no guarantee that the other person will be there. Or I'll be happy when, I'll be happy when X, I'll be happy when I get a bigger house. I'll be happy when I change my job, I'll be happy when. And then we do that thing, and maybe for a short time, we're satisfied. I'm remembering the badger jumper that you bought, that we talked about one of the other study mornings. You know, actually, that does give you some pleasure for a while, but eventually that jumper's going to go away, or I'll put it on a hot wash and it'll shrink or something, you know. There's no guarantee that the jumper, the house, the job is going to be around forever. What the Dharma gives us, what the Buddhist teachings give us, is the message that there is something that we can put our trust in that is going to be around and that does have all of those qualities that we're looking for that aren't present in the things of this world. Dharma itself, you could say, is what plugs that gap, the Buddha's teachings. Or really, what we're really saying when we're saying Dharma is things as they are, which you can see links, that definition of Dharma links back into what I was saying earlier about seeing yourself as you really are. Actually, if you can be with things as they really are, that sense of okayness that comes out of that experience, the sense of okayness that came when Kisagatami's grief changed from being personal to universal, that's what plugs the gap, that spirit of things being acceptable, being lovable, just as they are. For Pure Land Buddhists, we struggle, or for anybody I suppose, we struggle to come to that experience on our own. So we need to rely on something beyond our own, our ego, our self, the part of our personality that drives us, is the part that puts energy into those cycles that I talked about before. So if we rely on that to try and find a solution for this problem, it's like using a broken tool to try and fix a broken tool. It might be possible, but it's going to be very difficult. As Pure Land Buddhists, we have a sense that there is something in the universe that has already gone through this process. The historical Buddha has already gone through this process. Kisagatami has already gone through this process. They were relying on something. Whether you call that the spirit of the Buddha's teachings or the Dharma or things as they are, they were relying on something outside of themselves. We rely on Amida Buddha, this enlightened being, or the spirit of enlightenment that we still have access to right now, because that spirit of enlightenment, that Buddha, has already gone through this process, or already embodies the sense of things being okay as they are, things being lovable just as they are. When the Buddha experiences not having what he wants, he doesn't get consternated about it. Is that a word?
No, really.
Something like that. He doesn't get upset about it. You can edit the tape to put in a fancier sounding word later on.
Constipated.
Yeah,
it doesn't, that is well, a word. That's not the word he's looking for.
It's not, but it's maybe, you know, holding on to something. It's a similar kind of in a similar area, isn't it, Brian? He has a different experience of it. He maybe is sad. He maybe has gets in touch with the great grief, but he has a sense of, okay, this is how it is at the moment. And that's what we should be. You know, that's the ideal attitude to have when we haven't got something. If it's something that we can't get. Okay, that's how it is at the moment. But we struggle to do that for ourselves. If we can have a sense of this spirit of enlightenment, of this Amida Buddha in the universe, that's already doing that, then we can lean into that sense and borrow some of the faith, the trust, the confidence of the Buddha in our own lives. So when we don't have something that we want and we can't get it, we can go, okay, even if I'm struggling to see that this is just how it is at the moment, I know that there's something in the universe, or even that the universe itself feels that it's okay for this to be just as it is. So in that moment, our practice becomes relying on something greater than ourselves to ease us into feeling this is okay, this is how it is at the moment. Why don't we do that more often if that's the thing to do? Well, it goes back to what I was saying about avoiding seeing reality. If we move towards that state of being okay with things as they are, or even if we lean into a sense of something in the universe, or the universe itself, having a sense of things being okay as they are. Alongside that, a process happens where we are brought to see ourselves more clearly. We're brought face to face with the parts of ourselves that we don't like, because that was what was getting in the way of us feeling that sense of things being okay as they are. And to get to it, whether we're drawn through that barrier, through relying on Amida Buddha, or whether we take ourselves through it through a psychological process, perhaps there's not really any difference between those two things anyway. To get to the sense of things being okay as they are, we inevitably end up seeing the conceit, the selfishness, the part of our experience that we were adding to reality that was causing us all the problems in the first place. And we don't like to see that. We'd rather go and buy a chocolate or another drink, because even though that doesn't satisfy us ultimately, at least while we've still got a few squares of chocolate left, we'll be happy. And we can always go and buy another one. So perhaps that's the final thing to say, is that what we're very good at is short-term strategies for dealing with not having what we want. We notice something's missing and we go and get something else. As I said in the beginning, maybe that's enough sometimes, but that can become dysfunctional. We can end up always relying on things that aren't going to last to take away our sense of grief, because in the short term they give us a sense of well-being, and they also mean that we don't have to look at the parts of ourselves that we don't like. And humans are very good at short-term solutions. In the long term, if we keep doing that, we'll keep experiencing all of those emotions, all of that storm of emotions that go alongside us not having what we want again, because we're not really dealing with the problem. But each time we believe that the short-term solution will work, this time, surely, the short-term solution will work. but it doesn't. But we believe it because we don't like to look at those parts of ourselves that are difficult, or that we simply don't trust that there is a state of being which accepts things just as they are. Both of those balance each other out, the faith or the trust that it is possible to get to a place of being with difficult things and being okay with that. And it's also possible to get to a place of seeing yourself and being okay with that. So what do you do if you don't have that trust? You can take my word for it. Not just my word, you know, all the spiritual ancestors have experienced this. This is what the Buddha was talking about. You can rely on your own sense of it being true. If you're in this room, you probably will have had some experience of feeling settled with things being uncomfortable at some point. Remember that that's possible. If it's possible with small things, it's possible with big things. And just try it. If you become dissatisfied with continually putting your sense of well-being onto things that don't last, try putting it onto something that will last instead and see what happens. I think that's all. No more need to be.